Disc 2.
The people should have as little to do as may be about the government, Roger Sherman declared. They lack information and are constantly liable to be misled. After Elbridge, Gerry said that the evils we experience flow from an excess of democracy, the framers took steps to guard against such an excess. There would, they decided, be a filtration or refinement of the people's will before it reached the Senate. Senators would be elected not by the people, but by the legislatures of their respective states. A drastic filtration, since in 1787 the franchise was so narrow that the legislatures themselves were elected only by a small percentage of the citizenry. Senators would also be armored against the popular will by the length of their terms, the framers decided. Frequent elections mean frequent changes in the membership of a body. And, Madison said, from a change of men must proceed a change of opinions, and from a change of opinions a change of measures. But a continual change even of good measures is inconsistent with every rule of prudence and every prospect of success. What good is the rule of law if no man can guess what the law will be tomorrow? Guarding against mutable policy, he pointed out, requires the necessity of some stable institution in the government. Edmund Randolph, as usual, was more blunt. The object of this second branch is to control the democratic branch, he said. If it not be a firm body, the other branch being more numerous and coming immediately from the people, will overwhelm it. Senators, he said, should hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their independency. The term sufficient, the framers decided, would be 6 years. Senators would hold office 3 times as long as the members of the Democratic branch. They would hold office longer than the president held office. And around the Senate as a whole there would be an additional, even stronger layer of armor. Elections for senators would be held every 2 years, but only for a third of the senators. The other 2/3 would not be required to submit their record to the voters, or to be more accurate, to their legislatures, at that time. This last piece of armor made the Senate a stable institution indeed. As a chronicler of the Senate was to write almost 2 centuries after its creation, it was so arranged that while the House of Representatives would be subject to total overturn every 2 years, and the presidency every 4, the Senate, as a Senate, could never be repudiated. It was fixed, through the staggered term principle, so that only 1/3 of the total membership would be up for re-election every 2 years. It is therefore literally not possible for the voters ever to get at anything approaching a majority of the members of the institution at any one time. Randolph's desiderata, firmness and independency, are picked up repeatedly in the convention's deliberations. Over and over again it is emphasized that the Senate must be firm and independent. And the firmness about which the delegates were talking was firmness and independence against public opinion. That, for example, was Alexander Hamilton's rationale for vesting in the Senate the power to try impeachments. Where else, then, in the Senate could have been found a tribunal sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent? What other body would be likely to feel confidence enough in its own situation to preserve, unawed and uninfluenced, the necessary impartiality between an individual accused and the representatives of the people, his accusers? Additional armor was bolted into place. Some of it was to emphasize the difference between members of the Senate and members of the House. Because, as Madison explained, the senatorial trust, requiring greater extent of information and stability of character, required at the same time that the senator should have reached a period of life most likely to supply those advantages. A man could become a member of the House of Representatives at the age of 25. He could not become a senator until he was at least 30. And, as the Senate is to have the power of making treaties and managing our foreign affairs, and consequently there is peculiar danger and impropriety in opening it to those who have foreign attachments, a senator was required to have been a citizen for longer, 9 years instead of 7. The coat of constitutional mail bolted around the Senate was sturdy indeed, by design. Under the new Constitution, the power of the executive and the power of the people would be very strong. So to enable the Senate to stand against these powers, to stand against them for centuries to come, the framers of the Constitution made the Senate very strong. wanting it to protect not only the people against their rulers, but the people against themselves, they bolted around it armor so thick they hoped nothing could ever pierce it. And for many years the Senate made use of its great powers. It created much of the federal judiciary. The Constitution established only the Supreme Court. It was left to Congress to constitute tribunals inferior, and it was a 3-man Senate committee that wrote the Judiciary Act of 1789, an act that has been called almost an appendage to the Constitution. The Judiciary Act established the system of federal and district courts, and the jurisdictional lines between them that endure to this day, and established as well the principle, not mentioned in the Constitution, that state laws were subject to review by federal courts. And when, 16 years later, this new creation was threatened by a concatenation of the very forces the framers had feared, presidential power and public opinion, the Senate saved the judiciary. The desks, there were 34 of them by 1805, had been removed for this occasion, and the old Senate chamber had been arranged as if it were a tribunal. In the center of one wall stood the chair of the presiding officer, Vice President Aaron Burr, as if he were the chief judge, and extending on his right and left were high-backed, crimson-covered benches on which the senators sat in a long row, judges in a court from which there was no appeal. Before them, flanked by his lawyers, sat the accused. A tall, bulky, white-haired man with a face so ruddy that he was called Old Bacon Face, but with a mind and tongue so keen that he was also called the Demosthenes of Maryland. He was Samuel Chase, a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, on trial for his opinions. A president, maneuvering through his allies in the House of Representatives, had brought him there, a president at the zenith of his popularity. In November 1804, Thomas Jefferson had won re-election by a landslide, taking 162 of 176 electoral votes and leading his Republican Party to overwhelming majorities in both House and Senate. Rarely was a presidential election better calculated to turn the head of a president, and never was a president elected who felt more keenly the pleasure of his personal triumph, wrote Henry Adams, who was, of course, no admirer. Such success might have turned the head of any philosopher that ever sat on a throne. Whether or not Jefferson's head was indeed turned, the president now focused his attention on the lone branch of government still dominated by the Federalists, resorting, in Schlesinger's words, to impeachment as a way of ridding the federal bench of judges whom he considered dangerous to his views. The Republicans succeeded in removing an alcoholic federal district judge in New Hampshire, and on the same day the New Hampshire verdict was handed down, the Republicans turned to a bigger target, Chase. And if Jefferson hit this target, it was widely believed, he would move to a bigger target yet, Chief Justice John Marshall, whose decisions had been angering the president. As a young man, Chase had been a fiery leader of the Sons of Liberty, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a member of the Continental Congress. He was a fierce and outspoken Federalist, whose handling of some cases since his appointment to the Supreme Court by George Washington has been called outrageously high-handed. But as the historian Dumas Malone has written, he towered in the Supreme Court both physically and intellectually. He had undoubtedly committed judicial excesses, but these were not the real issue, as was clearly revealed by Jefferson's key senatorial representative, William Giles of Virginia. Impeachment, Giles contended, was nothing more than inquiry by the two houses of Congress whether the office of any public man might not be better filled by another. A conviction for impeachment, Giles said, need imply neither criminality nor corruption, but only a declaration by Congress to this effect. You hold dangerous opinions, and if you are suffered to carry them into effect, you will work the destruction of the nation. Mere error in a judge, he was saying, was sufficient grounds for removal from office. Chase's conviction would have established a precedent that would have undermined the independence of the courts, and thereby endangered justice itself. Yet few doubted that Chase would indeed be convicted. The move to purge judges possessed of dangerous opinions was gathering momentum. In Pennsylvania, for example, the Jeffersonian-dominated lower house of the state legislature had recently impeached three justices of the state Supreme Court whose views were too federalist for the legislature's taste. And in Congress, the discipline of the Republican majority appeared ironclad, as was demonstrated in the House vote to send the articles for Chase's impeachment on 8 counts to the Senate. The resolution was presented as a strictly party measure, and in the 73-32 vote, not a Republican voted against it. 2/3, 23 votes of the 34 in the Senate, were necessary for conviction, and 25 of the senators were Republicans. Even if no Federalist voted against Chase, there would be enough votes to give Jefferson his conviction. A tide of public opinion, backed by presidential power, was sweeping the country. And then, in the trial of Samuel Chase, that tide reached the Senate. During the week-long trial, attended by foreign ambassadors and high federal officials, while before the row of 34 senators, Chase and his attorneys, among the most distinguished in the nation, sat in one box, the impeachment's managers from the House in another, a lot of words were spoken. The testimony filled over 600 pages in the Annals of Congress, forerunner of the Congressional Record. And some went to the point. One of Chase's attorneys, Robert Goodloe Harper, appealed for sympathy for the aged patriot, who, after years of service to his country, is arraigned as an offender. Placed at the bar of the court, after having sat with honor for 16 years on the bench, he is doomed to hear the most opprobrious epithets applied to his name by those whose predecessors were accustomed to look up at him with admiration and respect. His footsteps are hunted from place to place to find indiscretions which may be exaggerated into crimes. But Harper also appealed to principle, telling the senators that impeachment should not be employed against a judge or any official just because he held opinions contrary to those of the party in power. Justice, though it may be an inconvenient restraint on our power, while we are strong, is the only rampart behind which we can find protection when we become weak, he said. That principle was, of course, the one that had been so prominent in motivating the Founding Fathers to create a Senate, that the rights of a minority must be protected against the tyranny of the majority. And that principle was reaffirmed, not just by Federalist senators, but by Republican senators, and not by just a handful of Republican senators either. One Federalist, Uriah Tracy of Connecticut, ill with pneumonia, left his bed and was carried to his seat because Chase's supporters believed that every vote would be needed. They were wrong, as was shown by the very first vote cast by a Republican senator on the first article of impeachment. The vote by Stephen Bradley of Vermont was not guilty. So were the votes of 10 other Republicans. The final tally on the first article was 18-16 against conviction. For 2 hours, each article of impeachment was read separately, and each senator then voted, and on each count enough Republicans voted not guilty to prevent a conviction. Despite the power of a president, all during the trial senators had filed into the White House for dinner and private conversation, and despite the pressure of a party and the roar of public opinion, and their own anger at Chase's partisan words drummed into their ears over and over that week by the House prosecutors, on not one of the counts were the Republicans able to muster the necessary 23 votes. The man who presided over the trial understood the historic significance of the scene that had been acted out before him. At the time he was presiding, Vice President Burr was under indictment for fatally wounding Alexander Hamilton, and 3 days after the trial he would leave Washington for the Southwest, where he would shortly become embroiled in the shadowy intrigues that would becloud his memory. But the Senate seemed to bring out the best in him. Attempting before the trial to ensure Burr's loyalty to the Republican cause, President Jefferson, who had once called him a crooked gun or other perverted machine, offered 2 of Burr's relatives and 1 of his intimate friends choice governmental posts. But even Federalist senators acknowledged the dignity and impartiality with which the Vice President conducted the trial. Because of his fairness, one Federalist said, I could almost forgive Burr for any less crime than the blood of Hamilton. And Burr ended his time in the Senate with a speech that restated the great ideal on which the body had been founded. The assault on the independence of the judiciary by a powerful president backed by the power of public opinion and the refusal of the Senate to bow to those powers were fresh in his mind when he spoke, amid, as an historian of Congress has written, a stillness among both friend and foe. "This House," Aaron Burr said, "is a sanctuary, a citadel of law, of order, and of liberty. And it is here in this exalted refuge, here, if anywhere, will resistance be made to the storms of political frenzy and the silent arts of corruption." A senator who served almost two centuries later, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who loved the Senate so much that he wrote a four-volume history of it, would invoke the trial of Samuel Chase as an example of all that the Senate could be, saying that the Senate exercised in that fine moment of drama the kind of independence, impartiality, fairness, and courage that, from time to time over the years, it has brought to bear on the great issues of the country. In the trial of Samuel Chase, the principle had been proven. The Senate had been created to be independent, to stand against the tyranny of presidential power and the tides of public opinion. It had stood. The Senate chamber, gutted by British troops, was restored in 1819. Located in the Capitol's central section, it was a rather small semicircular room. Slender, fluted, gilded columns formed a loggia along a curved wall and supported a narrow gallery, like a theater balcony, with a delicate gilt balustrade. Walls unbroken by recesses and a low-vaulted, domed ceiling made the acoustics excellent, so the chamber was, as an historian of Congress has written, ideal for the ringing voices of eloquent men. And the deep, rich crimson and gold of its carpet and draperies, and of the sweeping canopy, surmounted by a great golden shield of the Republic and a broad-winged gilded eagle above the presiding officer's dais, made it an ornate, dramatic background for the 48 new mahogany desks, each with its silver-mounted inkwell and small bottle of blotting sand, each with a low-backed mahogany and red leather armchair, that were arranged in four rising arcs. And for 40 years after 1819, among those desks, at which senators studied reports and wrote speeches and letters, since most senators did not have offices of their own, the senators of the United States grappled, as once the senators of ancient Rome had grappled, with the concerns of expanding empire. Should the borders of the young republic be extended west of the Mississippi? And if so, how far west? To the Great Plains? Or even further, to the mighty mountain chain of the west and the shore of the great ocean beyond? Many senators considered this last suggestion ridiculous. When in 1824 there was a proposal for the erection of a fort on the Pacific shore of the Oregon Territory, Mollen Dickerson of New Jersey said there was no realistic possibility that Oregon, separated from the United States by virtually impassable deserts and mountains, could ever become a state. Even if its congressmen managed to cover 20 miles a day, he pointed out, they would need 350 days to get to Washington and back. Benton of Missouri rose at his desk to reply angrily that, within a century from this day, population, greater than that of the present United States, will exist on the west side of the Rocky Mountains. But the proposal was defeated. Among those desks was debated peace and war. Whether, once it was decided 25 years after the Columbia River Fort was debated, that Oregon was worth settling after all, to go to war with England over it, 54-40, or fight, whether to march against Mexico or instead negotiate for sovereignty over California and Texas and the vast arid stretches of the Southwest. It was at one of those desks that the first senator from newly annexed Texas, Sam Houston, who usually sat silently, dressed in sombrero and a waistcoat of panther hide with its hair still on, whittling away at small pine sticks, finally rose during a debate on the legal technicalities of the issue to tell the Senate bluntly that Texas was already at war with Mexico, and that the United States, in annexing Texas, had inherited that war. Among those desks was debated the great questions involved in the settlement of the vast new territories of the West. Would their land go to speculators or to brave and enterprising individual families? It was in the Senate that Benton proposed the Homestead Act that made him the father of the cheap land system. Would it be the federal government or the new states and territories who would pay for the roads and canals that would knit them together? And, of course, it was among those desks that, for these 40 years, was debated the great problem that overshadowed all questions about the new territories and states, whether they should be slave or free. It was not only Webster's reply to Hayne that preserved the Union. Among those desks, the desks of the Senate, men fought to save it for 40 years. The 40 years, 1819 to 1859, after the Senate moved back into its elegant domed chamber, would be called the Senate's Golden Age. In part, the phrase was inspired by the hue of the chamber itself, by the immense gold eagle atop the dais, by the radiance of the great chandelier, by the galleries, gilt columns, and balustrade. In part, it was inspired by the debates that took place in that chamber, by oratory as brilliant as the surroundings, and by the men who participated in those debates, particularly the shining figures of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, the great triumvirate. And in part, those 4 decades were the Senate's golden age because it was the period in which the Senate came closest to living up to the greatness that the framers had envisioned for it. During those 40 years, the Senate held center stage in the great arena of American history, becoming the focus and balance wheel of government, while, true to the principles on which it had been founded and which Washington so pithily summarized to Jefferson, it cooled passions, tried to reconcile the unreconcilable. For some decades after the founding of the Republic, the House of Representatives had overshadowed the Senate. Webster and Clay had been members of the lower house then. But now, as the population of the new nation expanded, the House expanded with it. By 1820, it had 213 members, and its membership grew faster and faster with each census, and became too unwieldy. Rules had to be adopted that inhibited the role of debate, and sheer size worked against calm consideration of delicate issues. And beginning in 1819, when the Senate twice stood fast against inflammatory House measures, and then, in 1820, forged the territorial division known as the Missouri Compromise, it was in the Senate, now the true deliberative body that the framers had envisioned, that were enacted the great compromises that, for 40 years, pulled the Union back from the edge of abyss. It was at one of those desks that Calhoun sat in 1833 after his return to Washington, a Washington buzzing with whispers that President Andrew Jackson had sworn to hang him if he returned. When Hayne had debated Webster in 1830, he had been speaking for Calhoun, then Vice President, and as presiding officer of the Senate, not permitted to speak there. Hayne was defending Calhoun's doctrine of the ultimate sovereignty of the individual states, of a state's right to nullify a federal law if it felt the law exceeded the power granted to the federal government by the Constitution, and if the government insisted on enforcing the law, to secede. Now, in 1833, Calhoun was a senator and spoke for himself. Jackson was still proposing a tariff bill the South considered onerous and unconstitutional, and was sending to the Senate a force bill authorizing enforcement of the tariff by military force. The South Carolina legislature authorized the use of the militia to resist. Calhoun continued to publish papers reaffirming the constitutionality of nullification, and Jackson warned that disunion by armed force is treason. "Within 3 weeks, sir," the enraged president told a South Carolina delegation, within 3 weeks after the first blow is struck, "I will place 50,000 troops in your state." Calhoun had resigned the vice presidency, and Hayne had resigned his Senate seat, so that Calhoun, named by the South Carolina legislature to succeed him, could present the South's case himself. And the South's greatest orator was seated at his desk, grimly taking notes, as Jackson's message requesting passage of the force bill was read. On the day Calhoun was to deliver his major speech against the measure, there was a heavy snowfall, but carriages jammed the Capitol Plaza, carrying people who had come to hear John C. Calhoun speak. While the verbiage of other leading orators of the day was flowery, Calhoun's was stripped bare, down to the bones of a remorseless logic. His sentences were often long and involved, as was the intricate process of his reasoning, and he spoke so fast that journalists considered him the most difficult man to report in the Congress. But he was a gaunt, unforgettable figure, his eyes burning in a pale face, his great mass of hair rising like a lion's mane, his voice ringing metallically in every corner of the chamber. The commanding eye, the grim earnestness of manner, the utter integrity of sentiment, held the galleries in anxious attention, as one historian wrote. His voice was harsh, his gestures stiff like the motions of a pump handle. There was no ease, flexibility, grace, or charm in his manner, yet there was something that riveted your attention as with hooks of steel. As he rose now, the galleries could see how much the 50-year-old South Carolinian had aged in a few months as he saw his beloved South being forced to the brink. The blazing eyes were sunk deep in his head, the furrows in his cheeks had become gashes, the lion's mane was gray now. To his opponents, the gaunt figure looked like the arch-traitor, like Satan in paradise. To others, he was a great patriot with his back against the wall, battling fiercely in defense of violated liberties. Consumed with his feelings, he paced back and forth between the desks like a caged lion. The force bill, he said, exhibited the impious spectacle of this government, the creature of the states, making war against the power to which it owes its existence. We made no such government. South Carolina sanctioned no such government. The force bill, he said, enables him, Jackson, to subject every man in the United States to martial law, and under the penalty of court-martial to compel him to imbrue his hand in his brother's blood. The senator from South Carolina paced as he spoke. The senator from Massachusetts stood immobile beside his desk, as he had done 3 years before, again wearing his blue coat with the brass buttons and his stiff cravat. As again, in another great speech, he defended the Constitution as the overriding law. The senator from Kentucky strolled among the desks, as casually as if they had been props in a theater. When he was a lawyer in Kentucky, it had been said of Henry Clay that he could hypnotize a jury. As a national spokesman for the Whig Party, he had attracted crowds so large on a speaking tour that it was said that he depopulated the fields and forests of the West. As a dinner party guest, he was so charming that the white gloves kissed by Clay became treasured mementos. He charmed the Senate as well. No lover was ever more ardent, more vehement, more impassioned, or more successful in his appeal than Henry Clay, when he was courting the Senate, an observer wrote, watching him, stepping gracefully backward and forward and from side to side, flourishing a silk handkerchief. An actor born to center stage. From time to time, Henry Clay returned to his desk to pick up his snuff-box and carried it with him for a while, taking a pinch to punctuate an anecdote, tapping it with a forefinger to emphasize a point. Tall, slender, and graceful in a black dress coat and a high white stock, his face was bright, playful, and grinning as he told his wonderful stories, his voice so penetrating that even in a lower key it rang through the chamber as inspiring as a trumpet. And when he turned serious, the stamp of his foot and the raising of a tight-clenched fist made the emotion visible as well as audible, an historian wrote. Harry of the West, brave Prince Hal, the gallant star, Henry Clay, who had been elected Speaker of the House of Representatives the day he arrived in it, leader of the War Hawks in 1812, Henry Clay, whose previous triumphs had already earned him the nickname of the Great Compromiser, now, in 1833, with North and South on the very brink of civil war, he proposed a compromise tariff bill that he said was not an ordinary piece of legislation but a treaty of peace and amity, a true compromise in which each side would sacrifice something for the sake of unity. The North, President Jackson, would, in the Enforcement Act, send forth alone a flaming sword, Clay said. We would send that also, but along with it the olive branch, as a messenger of peace. They cry out, "The law, the law, the law! Power, power, power!" They would hazard a civil commotion, beginning in South Carolina and ending God only knows where. We want no war, above all no civil war, no family strife. We want no sacked cities, no desolated fields, no smoking ruins, no streams of American blood by American arms. Calhoun rose to respond in a great silence, for spectators and senators alike knew how much hung on his next words, as so much had hung on Webster's words 3 years before. When he agreed to Clay's proposal, such was the clapping and thundering applause that the sensation was indescribable, an observer wrote. As Jackson's force bill moved through the Senate and House, Clay's compromise tariff bill moved in tandem with it. And the moment the tariff bill passed, Calhoun was on the road to South Carolina. He traveled, as the historian Merrill Peterson has written, day and night over snow-covered and rain-soaked roads, sometimes in open mail carts, in order to stop a state convention from taking rash action. When he persuaded the convention to repeal the nullification ordinance, the crisis was over. And the Compromise Act of 1833, that act created among the desks of the Senate, would generally be celebrated as an act of deliverance. Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, three men who each longed for the presidency and never attained it. The mark they made was in the Senate. But it was quite a mark. The battles they fought, sometimes in opposition to Andrew Jackson, united, often opposed to each other. Increasingly, Calhoun, isolated from the other two and from most of the Senate, were battles over the most momentous issues of the age, and the Senate was often the dominant arena in which those issues were decided. For it was not the White House, but Capitol Hill that was the epicenter of government then, and the Senate was the dominant house of Congress. As Peterson has written, Webster, Clay, and Calhoun were ornaments of American statesmanship in the era between the founding and the Civil War. At home and abroad, making exception for their common enemy, they were the most celebrated Americans of the time. All across the country their speeches were read as if the fate of the nation hung on them. 16 years later, in 1849, it was again in the Senate that Clay, 72 years old now, rose to again urge compromise. He had always been thin, but now he was too thin and frail. He had had to be helped up the stairs in front of the Capitol, and racked by the cough that his friends suspected was consumption, although no one dared even to whisper the dreaded word. He didn't stroll through the desks this time, didn't move about much at all, in fact, as if he was trying to conserve his strength during the 2 days he spoke, standing for the most part at his back-row desk in a far corner of the chamber. But he spoke with the musical voice of old, with the same passionate intensity. And at crucial points he still tapped the snuff-box. The specter of sacked cities and desolated fields was very near now, but he was still fighting against it. Victory in the war with Mexico had brought the United States vast new territories, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California, and the explosive issue of whether these territories should be slave or free was splitting the nation apart, and the dispute was being played out on the floor of the Senate, where for years Calhoun and his followers had successfully blocked admission of the territories as free states, had blocked admission while talk grew of secession and of civil war. If any solution to the problem was to be found, it would be up to the Senate to take the lead. Up to the Senate and to its great compromiser. For 3 weeks Clay had worked and reworked alternate plans, and then, having finally settled on a complicated package of 8 separate resolutions, one rainy January evening, haggard and coughing constantly, he had impulsively climbed into a carriage and visited Daniel Webster at Webster's boarding house and outlined his plan, to which Webster consented. And now, as his biographer wrote, brave Prince Hal rose in the Senate chamber and began his last great struggle to save the Union that he loved. From his position in the far corner, the long semicircle of desks stretched below and away from him, and his gaze traveled along the upturned faces of the men sitting at them, as he said, "I implore senators, I entreat them, by all that they expect hereafter, and by all that is dear to them here below, to repress the ardor of these passions, to look at their country in this crisis, to listen to the voice of reason." Sometimes the physical effort seemed too much for him, and he faltered, but he always went on, for 2 long days, and one observer wrote, When in moments of excitement he stands so firm and proud, with his eyes all agleam, while his voice rings out clear and strong, it almost seems that the hot blood of youth was still coursing through his veins. The wonderful old man! In a stroke, as Peterson puts it, he seized the initiative from the president, centered it in the Senate, and set the legislative agenda for the country. "What a singular spectacle," wrote the editor of the New York Herald, a newspaper long hostile to Clay. "Of all the leaders of the old parties, of all the aspiring spirits of the new ones, including the president and the whole of his cabinet, from head to tail not a single soul, not a single mind has dared to exhibit the moral courage to come out with any plan for settling the whole, except it is Henry Clay, solitary and alone." One of the desks below Clay's had been vacant while he spoke. It was a desk near the center of the chamber, third from the aisle in the second row on the right, Calhoun's desk. Calhoun's boarding house was just across from the Capitol, but Calhoun was too ill to attend. When he read Clay's speech in the newspapers, though, he determined to reply, and his supporters said he would be present on March 4th. The galleries again were packed, the walls were lined with spectators, and shortly after noon Calhoun came. "He was emaciated and feeble," one of his biographers has recounted, "his sallow cheeks sunken, his long hair now almost white, his step short." He had hoped to deliver his own speech, but he didn't have the strength. While Senator James Mason of Virginia, standing at his shoulder, read the words Calhoun had written, Calhoun sat at his desk with a great black coat drawn around him, and a journalist described his eyes glowing as he glanced at senators upon whom he desired to have certain passages make an impression. And the speech was as defiant as ever. It was on a great theme, the greatest and gravest question that can ever come under your consideration, how can the Union be preserved? And he said the question had a simple answer. Only by adopting measures to assure the Southern states that they could remain in the Union consistently with their honor and safety. The speech rallied the South against the compromise, and when, on March 7, 1849, Webster stood to reply to Calhoun, at his desk also near the center of the chamber, "Not since the reply to Hayne did the fate of the nation seem to hang so fatefully on the wisdom, eloquence, and power of one man." Standing in the same chamber, on almost the same spot 20 years before, Black Dan Webster had given a speech that would live in history. Now he began another such speech. "Mr. President, I wish to speak today, not as a Massachusetts man nor as a Northern man, but as an American and a member of the Senate of the United States. It is fortunate that there is a Senate of the United States, a body to which the country looks with confidence for wise, moderate, patriotic, and healing counsels." Webster, too, was old, but his voice still pealed through that chamber like an organ, rolling across the long arc of desks and the crowded galleries, as he continued, "I speak today for the preservation of the Union. Hear me for my cause." Calhoun had had to be helped from the chamber after his speech was read. It was expected that he would never return. But he had returned for Webster's speech. Not seeing his old foe at first, Webster said he regretted his absence. Then another senator shouted, "He is here!" And near the conclusion of Webster's speech, Calhoun engaged him in a brief, harsh exchange, at the end of which there was an exchange that was less harsh, as if Webster had suddenly realized that it might be the last they would ever have. The honorable member had, as always, refused to cloak his opinions in gentle phrases, Webster said. He did avow his purpose openly, boldly, and manfully. He did not disguise his conduct or his motives. Mr. Calhoun, "Never, never." Mr. Webster, "What he means, he is very apt to say." Mr. Calhoun, "Always, always." Mr. Webster, "And I honor him for it." Those were indeed the last words they ever exchanged. Calhoun's health deteriorated rapidly. In his boarding-house room, he said, "If I could but have 1 hour to speak in the Senate." He died on March 31st. His funeral was held in the Senate, of course. The great debate was to roll on among those desks all that year and the next, the great speeches coming one after another, Clay fighting for his compromise, Despite his poor health, he spoke 70 times during the debate. Northerners opposing it because, as William Seward put it, slavery was forbidden by a higher law than the Constitution. Once Clay's clashes with Benton grew so fierce that the Senate adjourned to give the tempers of the two old men time to cool. And there was at least one moment of greater drama still, when an enraged Benton left his desk and advanced on diminutive Southern Senator Henry S. Foote of Mississippi during an especially angry exchange, and Foote drew a pistol. The old frontier brawler did not pause, but continued striding toward him, shouting, "I have no pistols. Let him fire. Stand out of the way and let the assassin fire," until finally Senator Dickerson of New Jersey took the pistol out of Foote's hand. When, after months of debate in the sweltering summer months, most of Clay's plan was passed, the Union was preserved by what Peterson calls a truly monumental legislative achievement. Within 2 years of the Compromise of 1850, all of the great triumvirate would be dead. When, in 1859, the Senate, grown too numerous for its beautiful chamber, moved to larger but drab quarters in the Capitol's new North Wing, Vice President John C. Breckinridge, in a final address in the old chamber, summed up its spirit by evoking the Mighty Three, whose names and fame associated in life death has not been able to sever, and by pointing to their desks. There sat Calhoun, the senator, inflexible, austere, oppressed. This was Webster's seat. His great efforts are associated with this chamber, whose very air seems yet to vibrate beneath the strokes of his deep tones and mighty words. On the outer circle sat Clay. In the end, of course, the triumvirate could be said to have failed. The Civil War came. Ironically, it was in the Senate, scene of the great and for decades successful efforts to preserve the Union, that the fuse was lit that did so much to blow it apart. In 1854, Senator Stephen A. Douglas, to get a railroad built that would benefit his Illinois constituents, persuaded his Senate Committee on Territories to report out a Southern-supported bill, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, that would in effect repeal not only the Compromise of 1850, but the Missouri Compromise as well, by allowing the creation of a state, Kansas, under conditions that virtually guaranteed that it would be a slave state. Abolitionists assailed the measure. Douglas was to remark that he could travel all the way from Chicago to Washington by the light of his burning effigy. But Southern senators saw the chance to force the nation to accept slavery on their terms or break up the Union. For 40 years, the Senate had been the center of compromise. Now it was the center of conflict. As was so often the case during those great 19th-century debates, it seemed as if the whole population of Washington sought admittance to the Senate galleries, an historian was to write. It was from one of the Senate desks that Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, an uncompromising foe of slavery, struggled to rise when, 2 days after he passionately denounced the crime against Kansas, a South Carolina congressman entered the chamber, came up behind him and struck him again and again on his head with a heavy cane, while another South Carolinian, with another cane, faced the other senators to keep them from intervening. It was under his desk that Sumner's leg became so entangled that he could not rise as the blows rained on his head and blood began pouring from his wounds. After he finally wrenched himself free, it was among the desks that he reeled backwards and forwards until he fell. Whereupon Southern senators congratulated the assailant. By the time, 3 years later, that Sumner was able to return to the Senate, attempts at compromise had ended, and the smoking ruins and the streams of American blood were almost at hand. But did the triumvirate really fail? The compromises fashioned by Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, and by other senators too, Benton notable among them, might be said to have merely postponed the settlement of the slavery issue, merely postponed the terrible war. But another view is that perhaps nothing could have stopped that war from coming. And if that is the case, then the Senate's compromises had bought the time that America needed. An infant Union was crumbling. The Senate's compromises had held it together year after year, decade after decade, had held it together long enough, as if those compromises had been a great delaying action to give the infant time to grow strong enough to win the war and to endure. Writing of the last of the compromises, the Compromise of 1850, and of the senators who had created it, Senator Byrd was to say, "Perhaps the greatest credit we can give them is to note that the Civil War began in 1861, rather than in 1851. For if the war had broken out during the 1850s, when public opinion in the North was still divided over the slavery issue, we might today be two nations rather than one." During a period of about four decades, a period roughly coinciding with the years 1819 to 1859, during which the Senate occupied its ideal stage, it played magnificently the role the Founding Fathers had written for it. Its compromises cooled seemingly uncoolable passions, and its resistance to King Andrew in the Bank War and James Polk in the Mexican and in the Oregon dispute made it the Republican tribunate against aggressive executive power, the great bulwark of liberty and self-government against the possibility of executive tyranny that the Founding Fathers had hoped it would be. And the Senate was more. As Peterson says, "Beginning in comparative seclusion with a vaguely patrician character like the Senate in ancient Rome, its debates at first secret and then for many years barely reported, the Senate had emerged from the shadow of the House of Representatives as the first place of legislative deliberation and leadership. Whatever the cause of its rising prestige, the triumvirs who graced it, its smallness, only 48 members until 1836, its indirect election, which some thought ensured superior wisdom and made the Senate what it ought to be, a congress of ambassadors from sovereign states, perhaps even its superb acoustics under a low-vaulted dome, the Senate fulfilled the ideal of a great deliberative body, at once solid and brilliant." Contrasting the Senate with the vulgar demeanor of the House of Representatives, de Tocqueville, after his tour of the United States in 1831, was to comment that "the Senate contains within a small space a large proportion of the celebrated men of America. Scarcely an individual is to be seen in it who has not had an active and illustrious career. The Senate is composed of eloquent advocates, distinguished generals, wise magistrates, and statesmen of note, whose arguments would do honor to the most remarkable parliamentary debates of Europe." De Tocqueville was not the only foreign observer deeply impressed. The Victorian historian Sir Henry Maine said that the Senate was "the only thoroughly successful institution which has been established since the tide of modern democracy began to run." Prime Minister William Gladstone called it "the most remarkable of all the inventions of modern politics." On January 21, 1861, Mississippi's Jefferson Davis rose at his desk to end the 40-year Senate effort to preserve the Union by telling his northern colleagues, "It only remains for me to bid you a final adieu." Then he and four other Southerners strode out of the chamber. In the next weeks, all but one of the 22 Southern senators followed suit, leaving the Senate as their states were leaving the Union. Only Andrew Johnson of Tennessee elected to remain loyal. 3 months later, with a Confederate force on the south side of the Potomac menacing Washington and breastworks of iron plates braced on the Capitol's porticos, rifles were propped among the desks and soldiers sprawled in the red leather armchairs. The 6th Massachusetts Regiment, hurriedly summoned by the newly elected President Lincoln to defend Washington, 31 of the regiment had been wounded in a battle en route, was quartered in the Senate chamber. One soldier angrily hacked at Jefferson Davis's desk with his bayonet. Lincoln had insisted that construction on the Capitol go forward. "If people see the Capitol going on, it is a sign we intend the Union shall go on." And all through the war the great dome continued to rise above Washington as if to symbolize the growth of a great new nation. And all through that war, in its new chamber, a Senate freed at last by the departure of the Southerners enacted laws that knit together a mighty continent, filled it with people, and educated those people, acts that spurred the creation of a transcontinental railroad that bound at last the continent's far Pacific shore to its Atlantic, and made possible the development of its great plains, that encouraged its settlement by promising a family 160 acres of the public domain for its enterprise and courage in settling it, and that provided for the sale of public lands to fund the creation of colleges. The Pacific Railway Act of 1862, the Homestead Act of 1862, the Land Grant College Act of 1862, It became very clear as these passed the Senate how the South had for so long shackled the Union. After the war, among those desks in the new Senate chamber, there was another moment of glory, as phrases in the Constitution, "When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside," came to life. 4 years of struggle between a Congress dominated by radical Republicans determined to solidify the equality of races and humble the Confederacy, and a President more interested in reconciliation than in revenge. 4 years in which legislation of doubtful constitutionality was passed, over Andrew Johnson's vetoes, forbidding the President to remove federal officials or to interfere with General Ulysses S. Grant's command of the army without the Senate's consent, was ended when the House, under the leadership of Representative Thaddeus Stevens, "Andrew Johnson must learn that as Congress shall order, he must obey," voted by an overwhelming margin to impeach the President and send the articles of impeachment to the Senate for trial. On that trial hung great issues. Johnson's opponents wanted to save a Reconstruction based on racial justice, an historian says. But his supporters had an honorable motive, too. They wanted to save the presidency. At first, conviction seemed all but certain, so overwhelmingly did public opinion in the North demand it. As one observer wrote on the eve of the trial, "The condition of the public mind was not unlike that preceding a great battle. The dominant part of the nation seemed to occupy the position of public prosecutor, and it was scarcely in the mood to brook delay for trial or to hear defense. Washington swarmed with representatives of every state of the Union, demanding in a practically united voice the deposition of the President." Representative Stevens had coldly warned both houses, "Let me see the recreant who would vote to let such a criminal escape. Point me to one who will do it, and I will show you one who will dare the infamy of posterity." And the House of Representatives had taken the warning. Every Republican had voted for impeachment. In the Senate, with the 11 Confederate states still excluded, there were only 54 senators. 36 votes were therefore required for conviction, and 42 senators were Republicans. As the trial opened with Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase presiding and administering to each senator, as he rose at his desk, an oath to do impartial justice, Benjamin Wade, President pro tempore of the Senate and therefore next in line for the presidency, was confident that he would soon be in the White House. One of the Republicans, however, was Lyman Trumbull of Illinois. Trumbull hated Johnson and hated Johnson's stand on Reconstruction. He was, in fact, the author of much of the Reconstruction legislation that the President had vetoed. But now, Trumbull said, "The question to be decided is not whether Andrew Johnson is a proper person to fill the presidential office, nor whether it is fit that he should remain in it. Once set, the example of impeaching a president for what, when the excitement of the hour having subsided, will be regarded as insufficient cause, no future president will be safe. What then becomes of the checks and balances of the Constitution? I cannot be an instrument to produce such a result." Another Republican was William Pitt Fessenden of Maine, known for his reverence for the Constitution and for his independence. His level gaze, high-bridged nose, and firm lips and chin identified a man who would be intimidated by none, an historian wrote. Like Trumbull, Fessenden despised Johnson. Not long before he had said of the President, "He has broken the faith, betrayed his trust, and must sink from detestation to contempt." But none of those crimes were among those enumerated in the Constitution to justify impeachment. And now Fessenden wrote a friend that while the country has so bad an opinion of the President, which he fully deserves, that it expects his condemnation, "I will not decide the question against my own judgment. Make up your mind, if need be, to hear me denounced a traitor and perhaps hanged in effigy. The public, when roused and excited by passions and prejudices, is little better than a wild beast." When it became known that 7 Republican senators might be planning to vote against impeachment, the exact number necessary to prevent conviction of the President, the GOP was convulsed by rage. The 7 were deluged by what the Philadelphia Press called a fearful avalanche of telegrams from every section of the country, representing a great surge of public opinion. In Illinois, where for decades Trumbull had been a revered public figure, A Republican convention resolved that any senator elected by Republicans, who at this time blenches and betrays, is infamous and should be dishonored and execrated. James W. Grimes of Iowa was also refusing to go along with impeachment. So vicious were the abuse he was exposed to and the physical threats against him that they were blamed for a stroke he suffered 2 days before the vote was to be taken on the first article of impeachment. It was expected that he would not be able to attend the vote, or, as one chronicler sneered, would plead that his illness prevented him from attending to cast the vote that would end his career, and that the absence of his vote might give victory to the impeachers. On the day of the vote, however, the doors in the rear of the chamber opened, and 4 men appeared, carrying Grimes to his seat. Fessenden grasped his hand and gave him a smile. Although senators stood to cast their impeachment votes, the Chief Justice said Grimes could vote while sitting. But when his name was reached in the balloting, he struggled to his feet to say not guilty. The Chief Justice asked each senator individually, "Mr. Senator, how say you?" And 7 Republicans voted not guilty, making the vote 35-19, 1 vote short of the necessary 2/3. Immense pressure was then put on every Republican to vote guilty on the other 10 articles. But on each vote, at least 7 rose among the desks of the Senate and said, not guilty. 64 years before, in the trial of Samuel Chase, the Senate had saved the judiciary. Now it saved the presidency. In political terms, their not guilty votes cost the 7 senators dearly. The fate Fessenden had foreseen for himself came true for all of them. All were denounced as traitors, not merely to their party, but to their country. "We have had Benedict Arnold, Jefferson Davis, and now we have James W. Grimes," Horace Greeley sneered in the New York Tribune. All were hung in effigy, and all were renounced by the party organizations of their respective states. Not one of them was re-elected. But there were other terms. Shortly before he died, Grimes told a friend, "I shall ever thank God that in that troubled hour of trial, when many privately confessed that they had sacrificed their judgment and their conscience at the behest of party newspapers and party hate, I had the courage to be true to my oath and my conscience." And he remembered Fessenden's smile. "I would not today exchange that recollection for the highest distinction of life." And in broader terms, the votes of those 7 senators preserved the constitutional principle of the separation of powers. The removal of a president by Congress solely because of a dispute over policy could have transformed the entire American political system. The excitement of the hour, the great surge of public opinion, had demanded a president's head, but only one House of Congress had bowed to that demand. The other had not. The Founding Fathers had created the Senate to stand against the excitement of the hour. Once again, the Senate had stood. But that moment of glory was only a moment. After the Civil War, the Senate's golden age was over, and the institution began to turn into the Senate that Lyndon Johnson was to find when he arrived in it more than 3/4 of a century later. The Senate's power wasn't over, far from it. Reconstruction was crafted not in the White House, but on Capitol Hill. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 became law, and the Freedmen's Bureau a fact over presidential vetoes. It was Congress, not the President, that divided the South into military districts as if it had been conquered Gaul, and placed over each district a commander with powers as broad as those of a Roman proconsul. And although Reconstruction policy was created by the Senate in tandem with the House of Representatives, and on the joint House-Senate committee the dominant figure was Representative Stevens, during the period after Reconstruction, beginning with the inauguration of Ulysses S. Grant as president in March 1869, the power of the House declined, and the power of the Senate grew, and grew again. The expansion of senatorial power was to some extent a coefficient of the House's weakness. There were 293 representatives in 1870, 332 in 1880, and the House, without strong leaders after Stevens's death in 1868, became the place of din and confusion that was to be described as one of the most disorderly and inefficient legislative bodies in the world. With the majority switching back and forth between Democrats and Republicans virtually every 2 years, it seemed to be in a continuous state of reorganization, symbolized by the bitter, time-consuming biennial battles over selection of the Speaker and Committee Chairman and members. In the Senate, however, the two parties had agreed in December 1845 on a new procedure for choosing committee chairmen and members. No longer would they be elected by secret ballot of the whole Senate, a method which had given senators considerable independence from party control. Henceforth, they would be nominated in party conferences or caucuses. The Senate as a whole would vote on the nominees, and since the vote would almost always follow party lines, it would simply ratify the majority party's selections. This gave party leadership new power, enabling it to impose a degree of party discipline, and discipline was also increased, and Senate proceedings made more efficient, because party steering committees were given more power over the flow of legislation to the floor. In addition, the Senate was armored against the shifts in public opinion that led to continual transfers of power in the House, and senators were still chosen by state legislatures, often dominated by Republicans. The GOP controlled the Senate in 14 of the 16 Congresses between 1869 and 1901. Senate committee chairmen stayed in their posts, building up, year after year, power that made them figures to be reckoned with in Washington. Also, increasing the Senate's power in relation to the House was another development, the hardening of the custom under which the Senate would not consent to a presidential nomination if either senator from the nominee's home state objected. This senatorial courtesy gave a senator almost a veto power over patronage. The expansion of the Senate's power was a coefficient also of the weakness of presidents. The 3 decades between 1869 and the end of the century were a Republican era in the White House as well as in the Senate. Grant, Hayes, Garfield, Arthur, Harrison, all were Republicans. The Republican philosophy that Congress should be stronger than the President and the Senate stronger than the House ruled. The presidents were almost all weak, and as congressional historian Alvin Josephy puts it, after its experience with Johnson, the Congress by and large kept them weak. When, immediately after his inauguration, the war hero Grant, a political naive, began filling cabinet posts without consultation with the Senate taught him a lesson. Blocking one cabinet appointment, it forced the president to nominate the man it chose. It let other Grant nominees know that the same fate was in store for them, and several withdrew. Having refused to consent, the Senate now advised. Traveling by coach the 2 miles of Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, a senatorial delegation laid down the law. When Grant agreed to harmony, says Josephy, by his capitulation he confirmed, in his first month in office, control by the Senate Republicans over patronage and the government. Control that would last, with rare exceptions, for the rest of the 19th century. But mostly the power of the Senate grew because of the changes in America. At the close of the Civil War, the nation that sent senators to Washington was still primarily an agricultural country, its young manufacturing and industrial plant a child alongside that of a Great Britain or a Germany. But although the soldiers of the blue and gray went back to the farm when they laid down their rifles, many of them would later move to the city, or their children would move to the city. To old cities, into which at the same time European immigrants were flooding by the hundreds of thousands, by the millions, or to the new cities that were springing up across the continent. Railroads were knitting that continent together. Its gold and silver and iron ore was being hauled out of the earth in the West. Its black gold was being pumped out of the earth in Pennsylvania and Texas. America was in the midst of a gigantic industrial expansion. By the end of the century, from a child among nations of the earth, it had become a colossus. The great industrialists of the post-Civil War era, the robber barons of these Middle Ages of American industry, needed government, needed it for franchises and land grants for their railroads, for legislative sanctions that would allow them to loot the new nation's oil and iron, for subsidies for the monopolies they were creating. So they moved into government, pouring money into political campaigns and into politicians. The Standard Oil Company, it was said, did everything possible to the Pennsylvania State Legislature except refine it, with unhappily predictable results. By 1920, America's elective representatives had turned over to the railroad barons as much land as the states of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin combined. At the same time that business was going into politics, politics was becoming more businesslike. State political machines, fueled by businessmen's contributions, grew stronger, better organized. and with government necessarily taking on more functions in a steadily more complex society, tens of thousands of new federal jobs were being created, and control over this burgeoning patronage was solidified in the state machines, whose leaders became great political bosses. Finding that they had an identity of interest, barons and bosses forged what Josephi calls an unspoken alliance. In return for their contributions to the machines and favors to the leaders, the railroad builders, oil and steel men, pork packers, mining and timber interests, and scores of other corporate groups got public lands, rights of way, charters, subsidies, franchises, and other legislative advantages. And the stronghold of that alliance was the Senate. Some of the captains of finance and industry who ruled this era, Leland Stanford, founder of the Central Pacific Railroad, James G. Bonanza Fair of Nevada, who extracted $30 million from the Comstock lode, Philetus Sawyer of Wisconsin, a one-time lumberjack who made a fortune in timber, and who was so illiterate that he could not spell his first name, but so powerful that he bought men as he bought saw logs, decided to go to Capitol Hill, and of course it was to the Senate, elected by the legislatures, that they went, rather than the House, since why would men who controlled legislatures submit their fate to the people? During this era, the Senate numbered men rich not only in cash but in political currency as well. Gaunt, horse-faced Zach Chandler dispensed thousands of state and federal jobs in Michigan while he entertained like a king in his Washington mansion. Golden-bearded Roscoe Conkling of New York, the chief ornament of a gaudy era's public life, swaggered among the Senate desks, conspicuous among his soberly clad colleagues in a costume that might consist of green trousers, a scarlet coat with gold lace, and yellow shoes. His vast army of ward healers included the 1,000 employees of the notorious New York Customs House. During these 30 years, the Senate was the fount of political power, not only within the National Republican Party, which, as Josephi puts it, was more like an organized confederacy of many individual senator bosses, but within the government. An historian calls these decades the era of the Senate Supreme. But supremacy did not mean glory. Mark Twain's bitter name for the era was the Gilded Age, gilt atop brass. Dazzling on the surface, base metal below, brazen and tawdry, as the frantic rush to wealth, coupled with a morality suddenly loosened after the tension of war, spawned corruption in business and in all levels of government. The historian Vernon L. Parrington called the era the Great Barbecue, because the rush for a share of the national pie reminded him of hungry picnickers crowding around a savory roast. And sometimes it seemed as if the Senate was leading the rush. It was the age of Crédit Mobilier, the scheme in which millions in bribes were distributed in Washington by the promoters of the Union Pacific Railroad. The House of Representatives at least made a gesture at censuring its members who were involved. The Senate would not deign to make even a gesture. Crédit Mobilier came to light in 1872. It was only a harbinger of the scandals to come, of graft and plunder unequaled before or since in the history of the country. And in these scandals, senators were often leading figures. In his novel Democracy, published in 1880, Henry Adams called the United States a government of the people, by the people, for the benefit of senators. There were still moments in which the Senate grappled, as the founders had intended it to grapple, with the fundamental issues facing the nation. Outside government, concern about new problems was rising. As industry became concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, the old laissez-faire belief faded before fears that the huge new industrial combinations were destroying America's cherished freedom of opportunity, making it harder for men to rise through their own efforts, that the country's natural resources were being cornered and squandered by the few, that city slums were growing and farmers becoming a forgotten class. Americans confronting forces too big for them to fight alone asked for help in fighting them, from the only force big enough to fight them, the government, their government. It seemed logical to them that government should help. Government was, after all, a basic cause of the problems. It was government that, through its mineral concessions and subsidies, had made the mine owners powerful, so that the men who worked in mines worked their cruelly long hours in danger and lived as near serfs in company towns. Should not now government protect the miners, or at least make it possible for them to organize, so that they could protect themselves? It was government whose unconscionable subsidies of land had made the railroads powerful, and it was railroads whose freighting charges were strangling the farmer. Should now government not stretch forth its hand to farmers by regulating railroads? It was government whose high tariffs had shielded manufacturers, at the expense of the poor and of the farmers, keeping the prices of shoes high while forcing low the price of steer hides that farmers sold to shoe manufacturers. Should not government now revise the tariff system? It was government whose policies had nurtured the growth of the giant corporations that kept wages low and hours long and made women and children work in sweatshops and live in slums. Should not government now intercede on behalf of women and children? At times, during these gilt decades, government did help, or at least try to. The Interstate Commerce Act of 1887 established the first regulatory commission with power over a segment of industry. The Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, named for Senator John Sherman, the Ohio Icicle, made a gesture at restoring competition to American business life. But such moments were rare. The Senate's leaders during these decades, Republicans all, were men like spade-bearded William Allison of Iowa, trusted friend of the railroads and the banks, who sat in the Senate for 35 years, and Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island, the son of an impoverished farmer who made one fortune in business, married another, sat in the Senate for 30 years, and thought of sugar or steel as a social and political entity as deserving of representation in Congress as any state or group of citizens. Allison and Aldrich were members of the Philosophy Club, a group of wealthy senators who met regularly for dinner and poker. Their doctrine was the survival of the fittest, not surprisingly, since, as Senator George Hurst of California assured his colleagues, the members of the Senate are the survival of the fittest. These robber baron senators felt that the best government was the least government, unless they could mold it as a weapon and tool to help the strongest have their way over the weak. The response of the Senate, and of the House, too, to public concern was, in Giuseppe's words, to keep hands off of or to help the industrial development, but certainly not to get in its way. Before the Civil War, the Senate had been the forum for great debates, for thoughtful deliberation on the floor, that the Founding Fathers had designed it to be. During the decades after the war, the decades of the Gilded Age, it was, as the historian Matthew Josephson reported, behind closed doors that the real work of Congress is done. Moving noiselessly through committee rooms, parliamentary leaders perfected the process known as invisible government. Aldrich, it was said, had but to whisper in the committee rooms to pass or kill a bill. Since debate mattered less and less, senators spent less and less time on the Senate floor. The Philosophy Club ran the Senate as if it were a club, too. For more than 30 years, except for a 2-year Democratic interlude, one or both of the key appropriations and finance committees was chaired by Allison and Aldrich, as was the Republican caucus, whose decisions now became binding, and the party's Committee on Committees, which determined Republican committee assignments. The initial assignments of newly elected senators to committees had become the entree to power. Not long after the agreement in 1845 to allow parties to select committee members and chairmen, there had been an additional development. Since the agreement's aim was to reduce intra-party squabbling, it seemed only logical that the assignment of senators to committees, and within committees, their elevation to the chairmanship, should no longer be a matter of discussion, but rather should be subject to some arbitrary objective principle.
End of Disc 2.